From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, Bay Area English professor, editor, and fiction writer Jeffrey Green joins us to talk about his recently published volume of stories, Voices in a Mask, a book all about art and life and life and art, about Verdi, Puccini, Victor Hugo, Luciano Pavarotti, Placido Domingo, and the world of opera. He joins us for the hour next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Bay Area author and San Francisco State English professor Jeffrey Green has published a collection of stories called Voices in a Mask, described as a fictional fugue and praised by novelist John Barth as an operatic tour de force. It is a work of seven tales which brings us into the world of opera and the thin and often imperceptible line that separates life and art. Jeffrey Green is executive editor of Critique, Studies in Contemporary Fiction, and also the author of Freud and Nabokov, Novel versus Fiction, and The Vineland Papers, Literary Tales on Pynchon's Novel. He joins us in studio this hour, and good to have you here. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Well, I was thinking, how could we best distill this for my listeners? It's a labyrinth, a kind of Borges labyrinth that you take us into here, and a wonderful one at that. But a lot of it may have to do, I thought, with talking about opera as an eternal art on the one hand, and also talking about how art and life are so difficult often to distinguish one from the other. I mean, that kind of is really where you're working in that terrain.
Yeah, I think it starts with art and life. How do we distinguish between them? How do we distinguish between fiction and fact? How do we distinguish between reality and representation? And if we think of fiction as a kind of stage, then it's not that big of a jump to take fiction that's exploring its artificiality, its made-upness, and express that in terms of theater and opera, which are the most artificial or contrived art forms.
All involving, as one comes away from your work, realizing deception and masks and, to some extent, of course, illusion.
That's right. The one of the most important themes, I think, is the opposition between identity and disguise, which is the central tension in all of the art forms that involve writing, theater, opera, the stage, music, etc. Long ago, I was taken with something that my teacher, John Hawkes, the novelist, had been involved with Albert Girard and Leo Litvak and Jerome Charon and others at Stanford University, called the Voice Project. And it was an idea of writers having in their writing a personal quality of voice that was analogous to human self. And when I realized that singers' goals in opera and in all singing is to place the column of air into the voice, and when I discovered that this was called the mask and it was in the region around the eyes that would correspond to how we would wear a mask in Halloween, the figure of the parallel between disguise and self emerged for me.
In fact, it's that hollow region, as you write in your book, of the face behind the eyes and the nose, and when it's properly placed, you become the character.
And also most yourself.
And yourself, right. And again, the line between the character and the self is often one that's permeable and somewhat indistinguishable. Well, right onto the stage initially, we have an overture, we have a voice that comes out and addresses us, and I want to talk about that. But we also have a character who is reminded me, of course, of August Wilson's play, about 395 years and counting or something like that. I mean, this is a tour de force in itself to build a character around that kind of chronology.
Well, in the first story, which is the title story, there is a character who claims that she's either 395 years or 411 years, something in that territory, and is basically asking people to believe that she's lived all that time. And in formulating such a character, I am echoing and alluding to the well-known Carol Capick play called The Macropolis Case or The Macropolis Thing, which was made into a 20th century opera by Janáček. This character, Amelia Marty, in my story, is a retired opera singer, opera administrator, who becomes a successful, I guess we'd say, Anne Rice type novelist with a very fervent following. And in the story she creates, it's set in 1996, she creates a major scandal by storming on stage and criticizing a entirely fictional composer named Sir Flanders Floyd Lubber.
And there we get into that whole realm of another important dichotomy in your work, at least thematically, popular art or popular music. In fact, there's a lot about popular music. I mentioned Jeffrey Green and I have known each other for many years. He used to be a rock and roll musician. That's okay to reveal that part of your identity, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's not a secret.
But, I mean, there's this whole sense of vulgarizing art and popularizing it, and this is what makes her enraged, as well as plagiarizing, of course.
Yeah, I mean, there are different levels involved. As someone who loves popular music as well as classical and opera, I don't see any difficulty there. I think In the story, Amelia Marty is inflamed because Flanders Floyd Lubber basically appropriates, steals music from Puccini and then calls himself a composer. And in the process, changes the unofficial tradition of an art form. So I think tradition and maintaining a sense of tradition is very important, whether we're talking about classical art forms or popular art forms. It's a sense of seeing art as connecting us to all the people who have ever lived and all the people who will continue.
Well, you've made a lot of connections to people who have actually lived. In fact, isn't Amelia Marty based on a real onstage death of an opera star?
Yes. The reason the story is set in 1996 is on a specific date. That date was the scheduled premiere of The Macropolis Case at the Metropolitan Opera. And during this actual performance at the Metropolitan Opera, the curtains went up, and very early in the opera, a character climbs up a ladder and sings, "You only live so long." And then he clutched his chest and fell off the ladder to the stage. Some people thought it was great drama. Others were surprised. The curtain came down, and it turned out that the singer had had a heart attack and unfortunately died. The opening was canceled. And I couldn't help thinking that this tension between life intruding on art and vice versa was worth weaving into the story, except in my story, that story is the fiction, and the fact is what we're reading in the story.
It's also a story that was reported recently about a production in which a real dagger was used by accident. They thought it was a fake dagger, and the person was actually stabbed and died on stage. I mean, it just occurred like within the last month or so.
Which is a kind of uncanny, let's say, latter-day enactment of another story in the collection, this very vivid Morn, which explores how a prop dagger inadvertently kills a man during a rehearsal at the Metropolitan Opera in 1937 and the effects that had on the famous historic baritone Lawrence Tibbett.
We're talking again with Jeffrey Green, who has written Voices in a Mask, a collection of stories. Collection of stories which John Barth calls a novel. I mean, it is to some extent, get into this whole kind of academic almost question about what is a novel, but it does have many of the properties that we would associate with a novel because the tales are so interwoven. I mean, you wanted it to almost have the girth of and the depth of a novel, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a quirky thing to characterize. We could call it a collection of stories. We could call it a short story cycle. We could call it a novel. Rather than characterize it, I would hope people would read and enjoy it. But the things that I wanted to weave it together would be the themes that are present in all the stories, the references that the stories have to each other, and a character of an impersonated author, I guess we would say a intruding figure. The best, most recent example would be when John McCain inadvertently walked in front of the host at the debates. And it's that violation of our sense of form that happens increasingly in the stories, where an impersonated, dramatic imitation of an author intrudes on the story increasingly. And that becomes a running motif in throughout the book.
That brings us to the beginning and the overture, which I alluded to before, where the third wall is essentially torn down.
Yeah, I thought that a book that deals with theater and the stage should acknowledge that a continuing presence is always that voice from behind the curtain that's momentarily reminding us of something, whether it's to turn off cell phones or in some cases that the lead actor is not feeling well or the lead singer has laryngitis. But it reminds us of something before the lights go down and we're lulled into this world of make-believe. And I wanted to start with that character introducing the entire collection before we enter into this fictional stage. And that character returns at specific spots and ultimately at the end.
It's almost what we used to call, or what is still called, the voice of God, or, well, in fact, Faulkner called God the stage manager. In many ways, that's a perfect metaphor.
Yeah, it's very apt. Yeah.
I mean, as far as your book is concerned, I get a little excerpt so our listeners can hear a bit of what you're working with here in terms of your prose. But before we do that, I was interested in finding out, a number of things, and that is you went to such great lengths here. You actually interviewed Placido Domingo and Luciano Pavarotti, and so you brought in a lot of that real life almost from a journalistic standpoint as well as historical, biographical, and fictional.
Yeah, so many writers and conductors and singers were very generous in humoring my questions, in discussing things with me, in providing me with stories or information. And the fiction weaves in real life events and real lore from the history of the opera. So I try to do that as much as possible, in some cases actually using excerpts from newspaper accounts of events in the past or biographies to give a flavor that I am, as you said, as the literary director, arranging in a particular artificial form.
You're paring your fingernails, as Joyce said. You know, you're creating your world and you're standing apart from it. But also there's a self-reflexive commentary here on art itself. Maybe fiction is the more real world than the world that we call reality.
Yeah, a review of the book mentioned, and I thought it was a good way of putting it, Pache Ray Carver, that one of the things that the book is concerned with ought to be what we talk about when we talk about art. And in effect, I think that that's good and apt.
There's also we interviewed Federica von Stade, who I think you also spoke to in preparation of this book.
Oh, yes. She was very helpful.
And we talked about the whole bel canto tradition, and there's the line of continuity that you're working with here, showing that it goes back centuries and showing really that historical, well, genesis to some extent of it, but also how there's bliss and there's transcendence of time when it comes to something like operatic art.
Yes, the one of the most inspirational things for me was when Federica von Stade did the version of the Bellini opera La Sonnambula several decades ago at the San Francisco Opera in the version that was written by Bellini for mezzo-soprano for a singer who was a sensation in the early 19th century. And her father, Manuel Garcia, was one of the first great opera singers. And
this is Maria Malibran?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Created a method of production of the voice that's connected with bel canto. And it's bel canto singing that Flicka is particularly adroit about, as well as modest. And it's the sense of the musical line being expressed in a long, prolonged, continuous, exquisite phrase, and that phrase after phrase is tinged with emotion and great emotional content and expressivity.
So I need to ask you, was the theater actually saved as a result of Maria Malibran doing Bellini in Venice?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And the
I didn't know if it was fiction or true.
The Teatro Malibran in Venice was named after Maria Malibran. And when in Amelia Marti's story, it's set up that the Fenice burns down, but we know the La Fenice did burn down and now has been reconstructed. But they used the refurbished Teatro Malibran to set some operas while they were rebuilding Fenice. In 1996, Malibran was still pretty much as Amelia describes it.
And in your opening story, you also describe a kind of stampede to the opera, also based on history. Reminded me of what happened at Walgreens over the holidays almost. I mean, it was just rushing in to see the opera.
That's, I think, a little bit more characteristic in New York at the Metropolitan Opera, where I think it's true. You see all these elegant people prepared for enjoyable night out, and then they press upon the door and push themselves in, and it's more than a little ironic.
Talking to Jeffrey Green again, his book is Voices in a Mask. Don't you give us a little sample? Can you read from the text? Maybe from that opening story?
Okay.
Which is the title story, by the way.
Yes. And in this opening story, after the scene with Sir Flanders Floyd Lubber, Amelia Marty has set up an interview with a New York Times reporter.
I'm sorry, Jeffrey, but those names, so it's almost kind of like Unctuous Jones. You've got names in there that are right out of Cartoonville, which I really like. But go ahead.
Yeah, I like the idea of in the 1700s that names of characters would help describe them.
And, it's very Dickensian.
And Thackeray, Sterne, and someone has to keep that tradition alive. I've tried to do my best with it. At any rate, the New York Times reporter Krista Vitek is inadvertently, her name recalls the name from the play and opera The Micropolis Case. And she's confronting Amelia Marty about the implausible nature of her story. And to get background, she's interviewed Amelia's physician, Dr. Eros Mortati, and he's presented her with a different version of Amelia's reality. And I'll read just a little of the exchange between Krista and Amelia. "But Miss Marty, his story is more reasonable. According to Dr. Mortati, you're a 96-year-old woman who, as a result of unbelievably skillful plastic surgery, appears to be half that age. In your version of the fable, you are either 395 or 411 years old, and you've confounded medical science by means of cosmetic surgery, chiropractic, and melatonin. His version, though far-fetched, at least has some degree of plausibility. Your account is utterly preposterous. Look around you, my child." Miss Marty's voice was soft and soothing. "The curtains are closed so as to blot out the light. In this soft light, does it matter so much whether I am 96 years old or four times that age? When you suspend your disbelief to accept Mortati's tale, how much more effort is needed to embrace the details of my story? Opera and fiction are both like that, Krista. They occur in their own special realms, apart from life, but in their own unique manner, connected to life. Once you enter the opera house and the lights dim and the curtains part, once you open the pages of your novel and the actual world recedes, your attention is focused on a projected, masked stage, a theater of imaginary beings and voices conveying elusive and evanescent glimpses of eternity. I live for those flashes of uncanny insight, Krista. It is my calling to evoke that sudden shudder of empathy and ecstasy that we associate with what is beautiful and human both."
All right. Okay, let me open the phone lines. We're talking about opera. We're talking about The Voice and His Mask, Life and Art, Opera and Fiction with Jeffrey Green. Join us toll free, 866-733-6786. You can weigh in here. We welcome your calls. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Jeffrey Green, who has published a book called Voices in a Mask, and certainly you're welcome to join in here in this conversation in any way you'd like to. But really, what I'd like to encourage listeners to talk about is just that thin gossamer line that exists between art and life, and to perhaps open up a conversation here about your responses to the whole notion of the voice and the mask and how that's used to create art, because indeed it's integral to any kind of artistic creation, but also the sense that you might have or you might want to render to us about, well, how much the shudder that Jeffrey just read about and that sense of evanescence is, let's say, moving into a realm of art, into the novel or into the world of opera, more enthralling, more exciting, more gratifying than, say, for some of you, in many ways, living in the world, you know, doing things that in the world can create a shudder, you know, going down a ski slope or looking at a beautiful sunset or whatever. It's kind of a perennial question. Margaret Atwood once said to me, you know, that whole question about art and life, you know, it's come up in so many seminars and so forth. Jeffrey Green, of course, dealing with it in a very original way here in Voices in a Mask. But I'd like to hear what listeners have to say about just the difference for you between creation, let's say, and what we call art, whether it's opera, whether it's fictional art, and life, and the kind of umbilical cord that seems to connect the two and endure in terms of that connection. You're welcome to join us. In fact, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, we welcome your calls, Sirius XM satellite now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Your thoughts and your reflections on this whole question of art and illusion versus what we call reality, or maybe not even versus, together, working together, which they often do in so many instances. And you can also join us by email. Our email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. Jeff, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Happy New Year. Today, your 2 hours have gone out of the greenhouse and onto the green. That's interesting. I want to say, yeah, Jeff, I've definitely got to get your book. It sounds great. I can't believe that you're mentioning the Micropolis case, because that story about that 1996 incident, the tenor's name was Richard Vercel. He was 60 years old. And that has always stayed with me. I must have relayed that to people like 100 times. It's also interesting that prior to that performance in Micropolis' case, he was also in the previous opera a couple weeks before, which was Kurt Weill's Mahagoni. So you had two operas, both words starting with M, four syllables, and rarely, if ever, performed at the Met. That performance production was with Jesse Norman. We had it here, I think, the previous season in San Francisco, where it was actually sung in Czech, and that opened up the whole world of Janáček for me and all of his operas, and it's just wonderful. What I wanted to say in regarding to something you mentioned before, and the question of vulgarity, because to me, I think the problem with a lot of these of current stagings of operas, more so in Europe, but to some extent over here, is this: it's not dumbing down, it's or spicing up. I don't know what to say, but it seems like opera production has entered a new age of where the director is king. You know, a kind of auteur thing. And in some cases, the music is totally lost, or the audience is grossed out, or what I think is worst is the composer and the performing singers, their work and their art is really, really disrespected. I'm not saying that every Bohème and Traviata has to look exactly the same with exactly period costumes, but you know, the thing to me that's so majestic and beautiful about opera as all live music, as I learned earlier from attending like 200 Grateful Dead concerts all over the place, the magic of the moment and the music. And some operas could even be staged, you know, as concert performances, and you could still get that spark.
Now, Jeff, you're saying you dislike the artificiality that's become more perhaps prevalent in opera, which is interesting in light of the question I'm posing about, you know, illusion versus reality and so forth. But let me get Jeff Green to respond to your remarks. Here, I'm curious to know what he has to say, Jeff.
Well, there's a lot in what you say, Jeff. On one level, I think that there is a inherent drama in the music that's central to opera, and that without good voices and without musical singers, we have nothing. We could want more stagecraft, but the reverse, to have an elaborate staging with singers who are unmusical or incapable is much more painful. One of the stories in my book, Your Sister and Some Wine, actually explores this controversy about what's sometimes called Eurotrash or Regia Teatra, the idea of the excessively dramatized production. And in this story, the opera that's being played with and played upon is Verdi's Rigoletto. Without realizing it, the main character is an opera director of the sort that you're alluding to, Jeff. She doesn't realize that she's a female Rigoletto, and she's in the process of producing a version of Rigoletto in Los Angeles in 1990 that's going to be in the L.A. Coliseum. And she's got important grant support, and she discovers that, to her chagrin, this is during the first Father Bush administration, where there was a controversy about the National Endowment of the Arts, and she finds that all of her grant support is pulled, and her production is so contrived and so elaborate that she's able to repackage it and pitch it as an episode of Columbo on television.
There again is your, high art versus, there really is kind of maybe too much emphasis put on the high arts versus, you mentioned right in the first story, Barbara Streisand and Madonna and Michael Bolton and Helen Reddy. And like you said, you can enjoy that kind of music just like you can enjoy opera. It's just maybe different parts that they're enjoying.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that opera is inherently and historically a popular art form.
Just like Shakespeare was an important, now it's
absolutely
become part of the high art, it's for the masses.
In the United States, that's probably, that sense of it being high art is exaggerated because so much of the support for our art forms here is privatized. But in other places, in Europe, one hears in Italy, for instance, street musicians playing airs from Verdi operas, and people of every walk of life are exposed to opera. In the 19th century, it helped create countries and topple them, and was not a elite art form whatsoever. And I think we could say the same about literature.
What did you think when they started offering translations on stage of opera? Do you think this is essentially good for the art? Because some have, especially those who are multilingual, feel that it's maybe even debased the art. And like with good literature, you can't really get a great translation always.
I thought it was great in the sense that anything that allows people to have greater familiarity with an art form is positive. One is not, however, forced or compelled to look at the super titles. So if you're really familiar with something, if you're at a baseball game, for instance, you don't need to check the balls and strikes if you already know them. Once one is sufficiently familiar, there is more to be gleaned on stage when you keep your eye on the singers and the events. But if you don't know an opera or need to be reminded or refreshed, the super titles are fine, and they come in a variety of forms.
Lee Ellen, join
Hello.
Us. You're on the air. Hi.
Thanks. Oh, interesting topic. I'm a San Francisco performance artist. I sing in tunnels. And part of my coursework many years ago at San Francisco State was at the Center for Interdisciplinary Art. And our core studies were about life art. What is the boundary? Where do you cross the line? And Ellen Zweig was teaching the courses then, and one of the books that we read was How to Imagine, the narrative on art, agriculture, and creativity. And I certainly do keep in mind that concept and that realm of, you know, when is it art and when is it real life, constantly when I'm performing it. It creeps into and makes my life interesting and scintillating in rather ordinary occasions, too.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. And to me, it's a fascinating question. And I'm certain that other listeners will perhaps want to join in here and weigh in terms of their own concerns or your own thoughts and ruminations on that score. I always think, of course, about the plays, the thing in which will capture the conscience of the king. I mean, Hamlet having the play within the play, which reflects upon reality, and it's mimetic, and it, you know, stages things to get Claudius's conscience involved and so forth. There's about the thinnest line. And then Stoppard, you know, builds a whole play out of these two minor characters from the play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and their roles in reality versus their roles in that play and constantly moving back and forth.
Yeah, I don't think we sufficiently recognize the shock it must have been for audiences in the Shakespeare Theater to see a stage and an audience on stage, almost as if a mirror were reflecting them. And these gestures in Shakespeare, or for instance, the ending of The Tempest, where the actors, in effect, acknowledge that they're actors and address the audience, these are gestures that I think are very important to remind us of the way, let's say, coming out of a movie matinee of a film that's very absorbing and a lot of time and events have transpired, we're shocked that it's still daylight. These things are important to remind us of these boundaries between life and art.
It's also many examples come to mind, but I can't help thinking about just a soft kind of sentimental play like Tennessee Williams' Last Menagerie, where Tom Wingfield comes out and addresses the audience and says, you know, I'm a magician and I have tricks up my sleeves and so forth. And then suddenly you're in the play, supposedly his life, but it's really his memory that you're seeing on stage. And of course, it's also tied in with many of Tennessee Williams' own personal memories. I'm going to go to more calls here in just a moment, but I want to ask you something completely unrelated to life and art, and that is, Jeff brought up the Met, and the Met certainly plays a role in your book. What do you think about the Met versus, say, the San Francisco Opera?
Well, I think they're both great, and we have really quality operas sprouting up all over. There may not be as many recordings being issued, but more and more people are becoming aware of opera, in part due to these popularization efforts of Peter Gelb in New York and David Gockley here. The quality of both operas is very high, and I think that we in San Francisco ought to be justly proud of our institution, and it's one of a mere handful that carries on this quality that connects us back to the finest of the art forms of opera.
Have you seen San Jose's opera at all? Or?
Yes, and San Jose has a fine opera company, but its conception is a little different. It's designed to present entertaining operas of singers who are emerging, so that it's kind of a master class or finishing advanced opera singers getting polished before they would go on to major houses.
Just like it was in Max's Opera Cafe when it first opened.
Exactly.
You know, waiters and waitresses would come by and sing. Helen, join us. Hi, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello. Yes, I was just wondering if perhaps your guests had heard about, I think you've been talking about it, but I know it as guerrilla opera. And it comes out of New York by Peter Geller, I think, who you mentioned. One of his, I guess you'd call it disciples, lives up in Edmonton, Canada now. She just recently moved there. And she has taken that concept, and she puts on, she produces and directs these operas. The one, the first one she did was Pagliacci, and it was in a tent, which you would see is logical, right? In a circus-like tent in a big park in the middle of Edmonton. It was quite a success. She was having a bit of a problem with the local opera devotees who didn't like this sort of down-to-earth, realistic version of opera. She changes the libretto a little bit, but it's sort of like opera for the general population, for those of us who aren't really into opera. And the venues are always very interesting. And so her next production is going to be on a barge in August. She had, when she did this, she got great reviews. Particularly the most notable was the Global, I think it's called the Global News out of Canada, which is the equivalent of our New York Times. Anyway, I just was wondering if he had heard anything about this concept.
Well, let's find out. Professor Green, do you know them?
Oh, I've read about efforts mainly in New York, in various parks and very small improvisational companies. But I think that what this does is highlight and dramatize the fact that no elite or advanced knowledge is needed to appreciate and participate in opera, or for that matter, any of our great art forms.
You have, though, it seems to me, a greater appreciation, at least one could judge from reading your book, of things like just use the librettos as an example, of Don Giovanni, of Rigoletto, of Tosca.
Well, I think what I have tried to do is immerse myself in each opera I work with, and that would include the libretto and the history and the relation of the word to the music, so that in the story The Keeper of the List, which is based on Mozart and De Ponte's Don Giovanni, the libretto was very important because it tells us what the music is also relating. And in some cases, the story will follow the libretto. And I think that this is very important for people to get involved at whatever level they can. For me, as a writer and as someone who presumes to teach literature, the text as it's expressed in music is particularly entrancing and interesting for me.
Well, we did a program, as I guess you probably know, on The Bonesetter's Daughter with Amy Tan and the composer and one of the mezzos. And there was a novel that was turned into something very different than, I mean, it's almost like, in a sense, turning a novel into a film, isn't it, when you turn it into opera, the way they did with that novel as an example? It becomes a different form, really, doesn't it?
Well, it becomes a new form. I'm not sure that it's different in the sense that it changes the spirit of the form, but every setting is inherently true to its own form. Orson Welles once commented, for example, that he was inspired to create Shakespeare films as art by having the experience of attending a production of Verdi's Macbeth, which he found to be so dramatic and musical on its own that he could go on and make film that was Shakespearean art, true to its art form as well.
Here's a listener from Yountville, John, who this is kind of one of the responses that I was fishing for. He says, if I could find a way to permanently reside within Mozart's ineffable operatic world, I would gladly leave behind this material reality. Thank you, John. Here's Lee, who says, amid efforts to sex up operas with anachronistic staging, I found that a teen-oriented TV series perfectly embodies the heightened emotions of grand opera, especially ones like Verdi's Forza del Destino, without a note being sung. That series is the CW's Smallville, about Superman's youthful years. Since every episode leads to a life we already know about, the sense of destiny overshadowing everyone's life is palpable. But beyond that, the background music, lighting, casting, and cinematography all deliver grand opera. I doubt more than 1% of the show's viewers realize this, but still true.
Well, that's a very good point. I don't know the show you're commenting on, but it is true. And recently, very recently, KQED Television had a documentary about this, that many of the great composers of Europe who became émigrés as a result of the Second World War and the advent of fascism and Nazism ended up becoming involved in and tremendously influencing films and television and all the technologies that are spring from that golden age. And so the use of music in film and in television is extremely influenced by composers who were involved in opera and with musical principles and musical commentary. I remember once a very memorable conversation that I had with the late Carol O'Connor, in which one of his episodes of The Heat of the Night demonstrated a car crash and had it elaborately scored to a passage from opera, and it was almost in its own way a kind of poetry, and I remember very much that this kind of combination of alluding to the real world, recalling a movie because the whole series was based on a movie, and of combining tragedy and poignance was really the goal of why all of us are moved by art.
It's a kind of an offbeat question, but you're talking about Carol O'Connor. Of course, makes me think of his role as Archie Bunker. Makes me think of popular kitsch type stuff again. And last night, I'm flipping around on the television and there's a show called Desperate Housewives, which is like a soap opera. I mean, it is a soap opera. And I noticed there's a character there who's supposed to be gay, and he is singing opera. And the woman comes in and says, I was too drunk last night. I don't remember what happened. And she said, did we do something? And he said, look, I'm gay. I'm singing opera. You know, what? I thought to myself, it's a curious kind of stereotype. In Philadelphia, you know, Tom Hanks, gay and opera and the associations there. And I remember the late Grover Sales writing a whole article about how gays are somehow not associated with jazz music, but they're associated more with opera. What do you make of that?
Well, there's a usage of the term operatic in the argot, in the language, that has a connotation of over the top. And I think it's because opera is such a total or grand form of art involving so many different contributing art forms, stagecraft, text, music, extras, costumes, makeup, etc. So that there's a sense of over-the-topness that in popular culture melds into the stereotype of the over-the-top histrionics.
It's almost epitomizing the word diva, isn't it?
Yeah. And that term, which of course comes from opera, is now used to describe any
Mariah Carey, the diva,
singer.
Right? Yeah. It's fascinating. Let's get Rick on here. Hi, Rick.
Yes, hi there. I'd like your guest to comment on one of Puccini's less performed operas, which I find one of my favorites, The Girl of the Golden West, which takes place in Placerville. And my understanding is that not only did Puccini never visit California or the West Coast, but that the debut in New York was Puccini's only North American debut of an opera. And there's some other peculiarities about that particular opera.
Well, I admire that opera a great deal and would eagerly look forward if San Francisco Opera might conceive of reviving it. But in my story, This Very Vivid Morn, the Girl of the Golden West is alluded to as it seems to have an uncanny connection to the background of baritone Lawrence Tibbett, whose father was a sheriff who was brought up in Bakersfield, and also is connected to the story about Caruso, A Flood of Memories, because Caruso debuted the role of the tenor role in Girl of the Golden West. But someone once said to me that this was, in effect, the first spaghetti Western.
Let me thank you, Rick, for bringing that up. A caller said that the singer that was stabbed a couple weeks ago didn't die but actually came back and performed within a week. We were trying to fact check that, but at this point it remains a mystery. We'll see what we can find out on that score.
Well, the fellow Lawrence Tibbett stabbed actually inadvertently. He stabbed him in a dress rehearsal. He died.
He did die, yeah. Well, the book again is Voices of a Mass, Stories by Jeffrey Green. So good to have you with us, Jeff. Thank you for being here this morning. And we're here with you every morning, 9 to 11 in the morning. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back with you on tomorrow, if all goes according to plan. And I hope you'll join us. We'll be talking in this hour tomorrow with Jonathan Curiel of the San Francisco Chronicle, who's written a book all about the history of Arab and Islamic forces here and people here in America. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Dave Freeman, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.